Caton v. McCoy. Mr. Stegall?
Thank you, Judge Flynn. Judge Williams, always a pleasure. Judge Lawrence, I experienced from Peoria. I was in Indianapolis. We did a mediation. I remember it for that reason. Welcome to the District Court and the Court of Appeals, which are all – that's where the rubber hits the road in the purpose of this. We switched from the treasurer's office to the jail, a death in a jail case involving – we start off this case cuts both ways – a very sick woman. The sicker she gets, the more she needs care, the more questions on damages and proximate cause. India Taylor had congestive heart failure slash cardiomyopathy. It's also called diabetes hypertension. The record on many issues is not clear. There is a mention of heroin addiction in a prior incarceration. But then there was a hospitalization for 5 days at Methodist Hospital about in May, and this was an October incarceration, where there's no mention of heroin addiction. So that is certainly the jailers, the jail nurses, the contract nurses proceeded under the assumption or had in their records that heroin withdrawal could be going on. And that is significant factually because the protocols of advanced, the contract company advanced, require physician examination. She also, on entry, none of the things that were done that should have been done for somebody on for this particular prisoner, who on entry it was clear was a very sick, could be very sick conditions.
Well, the policies were all in place in the jail for dealing with someone that had hurt issues. They, in your view, they just won't follow.
Well,
because what policy can you point to that?
Well, I can policy. Well, the point I can point to is, as far as the sheriff and also the physician who controlled this, is they completely disregarded the policies and didn't enforce them. It was clear afterwards they knew nothing was done, and they attributed the death. The employees in the jail officers were outraged at talking about how the nurse had, in common terms, had killed her by not treating her. And the physician complains to the superintendent of jails, who says, okay, you better not do this. She made her own choices. Well, so the jail officers were really trying to do their duty. The fatal policy for the sheriff and superintendent, and I use them together. I'm not going to get into their distinctions. The brief does it as to which is a policymaker. We've got individual capacity liability as well. Is that he believed all he could do is just let the physician do what he wanted. And there were clear indications to the sheriff, to the superintendent, that, wait a minute, she wasn't receiving the treatment she required. The fatal policy of an absence, Judge Williams, a good question I'm getting to, is that there was no way for the jail officers to do anything to get someone treated, because it is the sheriff and superintendent's obligation to run the jail. And the problem here was the jail officers saw this, particularly at that video bonding hearing where the nurse refused to see her. It was a 1,500-hour video bonding hearing. She's vomiting severely. They think heroin withdrawal, which requires an examination. They know it. The nurse knows it. She says, well, let the person come on at 2,200 hours. Look at it.
Well, advanced correctional health care, Taylor, the sheriff, the superintendent, none of these defendants had any actual contact with Taylor at the time. They didn't know anything about her condition, and they weren't involved at all. I mean, the nurses were the ones on the ground, and I understand the claim with respect to the nurses.
Right. Well, the problem is the sheriff, superintendent, and the physician are the captains of this ship, and the reason for policies is to make sure that sick prisoners receive medical attention. And if the nurses are abdicating their duty, which they clearly did here, well, what policies did they have in effect?
Yeah, but you don't have any evidence that they've advocated that this was the first time or that this was some pattern in practice at the jail.
Well, yes. Fortunately, I can say you're correct, Your Honor. Fortunately, no one else has died because of this.
So right, no, but I mean anybody that's died or had difficult, you know, difficult issues. There's no evidence that other than this case that the policies were not followed.
That's correct, and brings to a point I raise is, do you get one constitutional free bite? To say your policies are totally deficient, you didn't force them, but nobody else got hurt. And the human body, fortunately, is a very resilient mechanism. And it's, as physicians will tell you, I remember he once said, malpractice occurs in threes, is it takes a lot. And this was a very vulnerable person who it happened to. So you have this situation with the deliberate disregard of the policies is for this particular incident waiting to happen. The fact that, fortunately, their bodies were resilient enough and other prisoners didn't die, and I've discussed your cases that sometimes the disregard of policy is so glaring that the single incident is enough. And in this, I submit to you in this case, the problem shows the absence of any enforcement of the policies and the deliberate indifference is all you have to do is talk to the jail officers. I mean, they check for head lice on admission with these sophisticated diuretics, chest pain, heart, potentially fatal symptom, no reference to the physician, the medication. We don't really know what happened the next time she was seen because the note was written after the death. And the physician comes in and pronounces her dead, doesn't look at anything about what care was given, and then the superintendent has actual knowledge of the jail officers who are trying to do the right thing. As my expert says, that's if you cut them off, what do you have? The glaring policy defect really was the jail officers are there. How do you get up the chain of command to somebody to call a physician and say, hey, your nurses aren't treating somebody out there. Check into it. Give it a call. That's what it would have taken is a phone call. The issues on which Judge Cudmore went off on summary judgment are intertwined. The proximate cause, I don't think there's much dispute. Well, there isn't any legally. Learned Hand said it best long ago in that deckhand case. We don't know if that ship's rope would have stopped the seaman from being washed overboard, but considering that's why it's put there, we think reasonable minds can differ. This is a medical case, but considering all the problems with her and the total abdication of anything that should have been done, her congestive heart problem, which tells you right away she's got heart problems, the chest pain, which tells you, can we prove with certainty what the medications would have done? The defendant's cardiologist says, well, no, we can't say. The opinion is they should have. They do have benefit. We don't know exactly. The reason is, of course, nobody's going to ever do a controlled study on people denied serious cardiac medications. So these are the unknowns, just like the ship rope. So we go into that. The other intertwined issue is the correctional care expert that I hired. And my point is that I submit to you that Judge Cudmore, who's an able judge, I would consent to again and have in the past and continue to, he just missed it here because applying his standards, you'd have to have a correctional cardiologist.
Now, isn't it true that, Steele, that... Dr. Weinstein.
Yes.
Could very well be an expert speaking to the issue of standard of care. But as the ultimate cause of death, which is what Dr. Moulton testified to.
Right.
Which is what you're trying to contest for the purposes of defeat, of getting to trial on this issue. If the district judge was not abusing his discretion and finding him lacking in qualifications, and I want you to speak to that now, the Weinstein qualifications, Dr. Weinstein.
Well,
if he's short on the qualifications that go up against Dr. Moulton's conclusions, what did you have if that's taken away? Aren't we faced with this situation where Dr. Moulton is determinative on the fact issue of cause of death?
No, he really isn't. Even when the motion was denied, I thought, well, I'll probably still get a good I should win, because he says, concedes that, well, the chest pain should have been looked at. A defibrillator could have prevented this. You didn't implant them back then, but there was a defibrillator there put on observation. It would have been available. That's an inference. He concedes the medication. Basically, what this case comes down to, and the whole point of why it's error to exclude Dr. Weinstein, is how much vomiting and diuretics was she on? And was there heroin withdrawal? Now, the error here is cardiologists don't see that. The fact that electrolyte imbalances from vomiting and diuretics causes it, it's a first, second-year medical school problem. Its example would be a contract.
Would your suggestion be that any licensed physician could, testifying to that would cause a contest between Dr. Moulton's analysis and that physician?
Well, actually, what Dr. Weinstein is being excluded for is using the differential diagnosis. He identified the three possible causes. You get the cardiologist, and he says, well, it's arrhythmia. He says so. I certainly that. But there's enough vomiting and diuretics here. To be honest with you, it's the general practitioner, primary care physician, who has the expertise in that, because if they see the vomiting diuretics due to the fluids, they never get to a cardiologist. So really...
So then you wanted him to really testify for three purposes. One, that she taken, if Taylor had taken her medicine, she might have lived.
Yes.
That's one. Two, that the vomiting could have exacerbated her heart failure. And
right.
Three, the prison didn't provide an adequate level of medical care to Taylor.
Right.
And you're saying those last two alone would be enough.
Certainly.
And that's the evidence you would put up against the...
Plus the cross-examination of Dr. Moulton, where he concedes that, of course, vomiting and diuretics, and in fact we get down to, he says it might be four, we don't know, vomiting, he thinks, but there's no studies. Depends on the individual. There's two. Judge Cudmore found three incidents of vomiting. Hey, this is a classic question of fact where the general practitioner, he isn't jumping beyond trying to figure out the cause of some sophisticated cancer or things like that. He's like the GP testifying to AIDS is caused by contact with infected blood. Always generally accepted medical. My analogy for the law I'm thinking up is you got a contracts problem and you're calling in a expert in credit derivatives that we're calling in. You don't need that person. We're talking about an offer to acceptance and consideration problem here is what causes arrhythmia. And by the way, there was
rebuttal time.
Yes, thank you very much for reminding me.
Thank you, Mr. Stegall. Mr. Jeanette.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is, may it please the court and counsel, my name is Peter Jeanette. I represent the medical defendants, Advanced Correctional Healthcare, Dr. Norman Johnson, and the nurses, Olivia Radcliffe, Pam Hibbert, and Patricia Mattis. With me today is Bill Atkins, who represents the county defendants, although he has graciously allowed me to argue the case today. I would like to very briefly address two preliminary points. First, the case as to Olivia Radcliffe was stayed due to her bankruptcy. I checked the status of that yesterday. She received a discharge earlier in April, and I'll provide the court with a status letter updating that situation. Second, Mr. Stegall made a significant misrepresentation of fact in the reply brief that he repeated here today that I'd like to address. And that is that he has stated that Patricia Mattis wrote her note regarding her time with India Taylor after India Taylor died. And that is absolutely not true. Patricia Mattis saw India Taylor on the morning of April 16th and wrote a note on the morning of April 16th. And there was a narrative. She wrote the date 10-16-03 and then a narrative after India Taylor died. She was speaking with Dr. Johnson and the officer who was investigating, and this is detailed in her deposition at pages 21 and 23, and they asked her to go back to her note and insert the time that she saw India Taylor, because while she had the date on the note, she did not have the time. So she made a notation there to indicate that, and she described that in her testimony. She wrote 0430 to indicate she saw her at 4:30 in the morning, PM, which was her initials of Patricia Mattis, and then wrote 0508 on 10-17-03 to indicate that she added that time on the morning of October 17th. But the note itself, the date 10-16 and the narrative, was written contemporaneously with her visit with India Taylor.
So let's go right to Dr. Weinstein. Why isn't he qualified to testify about the effect of vomiting on a body's electrolyte level?
He may be qualified to testify that vomiting can affect your electrolyte level. The point where he gets into trouble is the proximate cause issue, that he can't testify that she had enough vomiting to cause a serious enough electrolyte problem that caused India Taylor's particular cardiac arrhythmia. And that's where he gets into trouble, is trying to connect some general principles to a very particular cardiac problem. As the plaintiffs indicated in their briefing, India Taylor had a significant cardiac history, and she was on, as they described it, a sophisticated, complex regimen of medications, or was supposed to be. She actually wasn't taking them. It's a more complex picture than a general practitioner, and particularly one with the limited experience that Dr. Weinstein is able to testify to.
So your view would be that the jury then couldn't infer causation based on the vomiting and the inaction of the nurses in the case, where it's certainly that third nurse totally dropped the ball?
Well, I would disagree that the third nurse dropped the ball, but I don't think that they could infer that. First of all, that doesn't get over the question of Dr. Weinstein's qualifications. We've kind of moved on to his opinions there. Before he's entitled to give opinions, he's got to be qualified. And if he's not qualified, then we're left, as Your Honor indicated, with Dr. Moulton's opinions. So I don't think that there is enough there for them to make that a logical leap. As far as the conduct of the nurses, and you've kind of raised this, that gets us back to the deliberate indifference question a little bit, which the plaintiff really didn't raise in their briefs, and I think has essentially waived that argument. But I did want to kind of address that since you brought it up. She was initially seen at intake by Olivia Radcliffe, and the visit with Olivia Radcliffe was not as cursory as plaintiff would have you believe. He wants to say, well, they just checked her for lice and sent her on. But the undisputed facts are that she heard the complaint of chest pain that India Taylor made. She gave her Pepto-Bismol in response to that, and we know from the autopsy that was done that India Taylor had fundic gastritis, which would explain her chest pain, so we know that the nurse correctly assessed that. You know, there is a difference between chest pain that, you know, occurs with heartburn and such, and chest pain, which is a cardiac chest pain, which is the crushing substernal chest pain. That type of cardiac chest pain in our policies does require immediate physician referral. Just the generic indigestion type of chest pain does not. And all of the evidence is that is the type of chest pain that she had and that the nurse appropriately identified and treated. She also received the information about her medication history, and we know that she received that because Olivia Radcliffe wrote a note for the next nurse coming on duty that she has congestive heart failure, she's on these medications, her family's going to bring them in, and she allowed her family to bring, or allowed Indy Taylor to call her family to ask them to bring those in. The next nurse that saw Indy Taylor the following morning was Patricia Mattis. She was brought down for a sick call, and she was seen early in the morning. She attempted to vomit. The correctional officer had observed vomit in her toilet, brought her down to medical. She was attempting to vomit in front of Patty Madison Medical, and Nurse Mattis said, if you keep vomiting, you know, we can't give you medication that you take by mouth because you'll just throw it up again. And she said, okay, I'm not going to throw up anymore. The other thing that Patricia Mattis was supposed to do at that time was take her vital signs and stuff like that, and due to the attempts at vomiting, she thought that she couldn't take her vitals at that time, so she put her on the sick call for later in the morning to be seen by Pam Hibbard. And Pam Hibbert saw her at 9:30 in the morning. Again, I think there was some indication that she attempted to vomit or had some complaints about it, but didn't actually.
Well, Taylor's the one I was really making reference to. Because, I mean, not Hibbert when she saw her. Because Taylor had high blood pressure, she complained of nausea. Her chart reflected her problem with CHF. The fact that she had complained about chest pain at the hospital, telling the nurse on duty to call a doctor if her medication hadn't been delivered. The medication hadn't been delivered. She didn't prescribe any medication. She sent her to the cell. Taylor vomited so much that the guards felt the need to collect the vomit and immediately phoned her. And despite all this, she refused to see Taylor, refused to call a doctor, and told the guards the next nurse would handle it.
I think you have to look at that in the context that Pam Hibbert saw her.
Plus the guards wrote up Hibbert because they thought that she had not done what she was supposed to do.
And the guards obviously are not medical professionals. And Pam Hibbert saw India Taylor personally at 9:30 in the morning, took her vitals, had the opportunity to evaluate her, you know, at that time of the morning, concluded that she thought India Taylor was drug-seeking. And so when she got the call in the afternoon, and I would disagree with the conclusion that there was a lot of vomit, because Officer Eccles specifically was asked, was it a lot? And she said no. And plaintiff is asking you to, you know, make an inference, you know, based on that there was a lot of vomiting. But I think you can't make a reasonable inference that there was a lot. The officer who saw it says that there wasn't. But anyway, Pam Hibbert, you know, having seen her and evaluated her in the morning, I think was not acting with deliberate indifference, just to say, look, I saw her this morning. I don't need to see her again. It's the same complaints. She can see the sick call in the morning, and she would have seen the doctor on Friday morning had she lived that long. The complaints that she made.
If she had gotten her medication or the nurse had prescribed some medication.
There's no testimony that would support that conclusion. Dr. Moulton's testimony was that the medication would not have made a difference. We're talking about maybe one dose of medication. Even Dr. Weinstein agrees that the jail would have 24 hours to let family bring that in. So at best, we're talking about one dose, you know, on the evening of the 16th. Dr. Weinstein was not able to give any testimony about the efficacy of the medication, you know, the time it takes to have effect of that. The other thing I would point out is that she was still on a low dose of the medication. When she was initially prescribed medications by Dr. Schmidt back in April, he put her on a low dose of the medication, and he was going to titrate it up by doubling her dose, I think every 30 days or so, but she never followed up with him. So her dose of her medication was never titrated up to a therapeutic level. So, you know, giving her, you know, this low dose of medication maybe once, you know, was not going to make a difference in the opinions that we have before. So the doctors do not support that conclusion. See, my time's running short, so I do want to make a couple of other quick points. Plaintiff's counsel is trying to place some fault or draw some inference from the statements made by Steve Smith about the gossiping at the jail. And his email was specific to address the gossiping. And what he basically told them is, look, you guys are gossiping, I want you to stop it. He said, but if there's something to know, I want to hear why they think that way. And quoting his email, if there's more to the story, I want to hear it. So he wasn't trying to silence, you know, an investigation or anything. He was telling people to stop gossiping, and if there's something you really know, bring it through the right channels. Now, plaintiff also mentioned the presence of a defibrillator, and I think that it's a bit of a red herring. The defibrillator, they do have the portable defibrillators at the jail. Dr. Moulton was talking about an implanted defibrillator that's actually implanted in open-heart surgery, obviously not something that could have been done in the 36 hours she was at the jail, and not something that was indicated by the standards at that time. What he said the portable defibrillator would have been useful for is if the situation where the arrhythmia is witnessed and there's a collapse, you know, like somebody walking down the hallway and collapses, and they could be observed and responded to immediately, that a defibrillator might be useful in that case. In India Taylor's case, I mean, she was sleeping in bed, and, you know, Dr. Moulton has testified that when you get this arrhythmia, you might feel a palpitation very quickly, but you go almost instantly unconscious and essentially die in your sleep, which is the way the correctional officers found her. They said, you know, every time we came by that night, she was, you know, laying in bed facing the wall, which is the way she always slept. We never noticed anything different. Chest pain is not a sign of an impending arrhythmia, and the medical testimony was very clear on that part. The chest pain is completely unrelated to her death. I think that covers most of the points I wanted to make. If there are no further questions, I'll rest.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Janetti. Mr. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge. This highlights the factual problems here. The Schmidt he mentioned, she went to Bowman, who died, and we can't find his records. If you got to lose the state's attorney couldn't. If you got to lose records, I guess a deceased patient is the best to lose them. These are all things to resolve the fact finder. And about I'm suspicious about the accuracy of Mattis's notes. One, Dr. Moldon himself says she doesn't know what she's talking about of vomit. I can't tell from what she says in this note and make any conclusions about the amount of vomiting. The other factor is there's a missing, we don't know what on the initial intake, the reverse side's missing. So we don't know the nurse's impressions. We know Brano was there. He said she's sick and she was crying and then obviously sick and complaining of chest pains. The fact that chest pains may be an indication of myocardial infarction rather than arrhythmia, the fact remains you come, you're going to treat both. The defibrillator, if you're on observation by nurses, it's a lot different than just leaving him in the cell. And, again, those are all the factual. There's no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stegall. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.